Imagine like liquidating your entire 401k, selling your house, selling your car.
Breaking ties with your business partners.
Right. Cashing out your literal life's work just to buy a single piece of jewelry.
Sounds completely insane.
Totally. Or on the flip side, imagine burying a massive cache of stolen gold in a field you don't even own because you're terrified of an impending military invasion.
Which was a very real fear back then.
Exactly. I mean, to a modern economist, both of those scenarios sound like absolute financial suicide.
Oh, without a doubt.
But 2,000 years ago, they were actually presented as the ultimate blueprint for reality. So, welcome to this deep dive. Our mission today is to take a stack of fascinating historical, economic, and theological research and apply it to two of the shortest yet like most heavily analyzed texts in the New
Yeah,
Testament.
we're looking at Matthew 13, verses 44 through 46.
Right, which most of you probably know as the parable of the hidden treasure and the parable of the pearl of great price.
And if that title conjures up, memories of a sanitized, dusty Sunday school lesson for you, the sources we are looking at today are going to completely shatter that perception.
I really hope so because they are wild.
They are. When you subject these twin parables to the kind of structural and thematic deconstruction that scholars apply to ancient Mediterranean texts, they reveal themselves to be incredibly radical.
Yeah.
We're going to examine these stories through two very specific stages today. First, the initial discovery of immense value, and second, the resulting just drastic life change that follows.
Because what the research shows is that these aren't just quaint little moral fables at all. I mean, they are profound, gritty lessons in economic subversion, ethical gray areas, and massive identity shifts.
Absolutely.
But I feel like to grasp why someone would commit financial suicide for a buried box or a pearl, we first have to look at the economic terror and the rigid class structures of first century Palestine.
Yeah, that context is everything.
Like, who actually finds these things? Because the contrast between who gets lucky and who gets rewarded for searching tells us a lot about the worldview of the era, doesn't it?
Oh, that contract is entirely intentional. So scholars analyze these parables together because they're structural twins. In both stories, a man finds something invaluable, sells everything, and buys it.
Right.
But their socioeconomic backgrounds couldn't be more different. So in the first narrative, the hidden treasure, our protagonist is a day laborer, or more likely, a tenant farmer.
So a guy at the absolute bottom of the food chain.
Exactly. This is someone at the very bottom of the economic ladder. He works land that belongs to a wealthy absentee landlord.
Yeah.
He lives in a state of sheer subsistence, just grinding out a living day by day. And his discovery is completely accidental. I mean, he literally stumbles upon a buried fortune while dragging a plow through the dirt.
While the second guy is on the complete opposite end of the spectrum.
Right. The protagonist in The Pearl of Great Price is a wealthy, specialized merchant. He's upper class, he possesses massive capital and liquidity, and his discovery is intentional.
He's actually looking for it.
Exactly. He is actively, purposefully seeking out fine pearls. He is a professional searcher.
So it's essentially the difference between like a minimum wage ditch digger accidentally uncovering a lost Picasso painting buried in the mud,
That's a great image.
right, versus an elite art dealer who has spent their entire adult life hunting down a rumored hidden masterpiece.
It's a really solid baseline analogy, but there is a crucial difference when we talk about the ancient merchant.
Oh, what's that?
Well, a modern art dealer usually has a buyer lined up, right? They acquire the Picasso to sell it for a massive profit.
Sure.
The merchant in this text is buying the pearl purely to possess it. He is taking it off the market permanently.
Oh, wow. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, but looking at the broader thematic contrast you brought up, scholars view these two men as representing two distinct ways that people encounter what the text calls the kingdom of heaven.
Okay, break that down for me.
So the tenant farmer represents grace. He wasn't looking for spiritual enlightenment, He wasn't on a quest.
He was just doing his job.
He was just trying to survive a Tuesday. And he stumbled into ultimate value. Whereas the merchant represents the quest. This is the person who spends their life philosophically or spiritually searching for ultimate truth, analyzing every option, and finally, deliberately locating it.
Okay, that makes sense. But let's talk about the sheer mechanics of that accidental discovery in the field. Because, you know, burying treasure sounds like something out of a pirate movie to us today.
It really does.
We have to ground this in the geopolitics of the ancient Near East, right? Like, why is a literal fortune just sitting in a random agricultural field?
It basically comes down to the terrifying reality of life in the Levant back then. In the ancient world, there were no secure banking systems.
Right, no ATMs.
Uh-huh. Exactly. You couldn't just wire your savings to an offshore account or rely on FDIC insurance. And geographically, Palestine was a land bridge connecting the empires of Egypt, Syria, and Mesopotamia.
So everyone was constantly marching through it?
Constantly. Cool. It was being marched over by invading armies, the Romans, the Parthians, various local rebel groups and warlords.
Yikes.
So if you saw the dust of a foreign legion coming over the horizon, you had a matter of hours. You took your family's entire life savings, you put it in a clay jar, and you buried it deep in the earth.
Because if your village gets burned to the ground and your house is destroyed, the gold is safe in the dirt.
Exactly. You can come back and dig it up when the war is over.
That is so dark, but it makes perfect logical sense.
It was the strategy. But here is the profound historical tragedy of that era. Quite often, that family never came back.
Oh, man.
Yeah. They were slaughtered, or they were sold into slavery, or permanently displaced as refugees.
Yeah.
And because they didn't leave a map, that buried treasure was simply lost to history.
It just sat there.
Sat there in the mud for decades, sometimes centuries. So for a peasant farmer to be digging a trench and hear the metallic thud of a shovel hitting a cache of ancient gold.
That's mind-blowing.
It was unimaginable wealth. It was the ancient equivalent of hitting a $1 billion lottery.
And the economic absurdity is just as extreme in the pearl trade, too. I mean, today we think of diamonds as the ultimate flawless gemstone, but the research points out that in antiquity, diamonds weren't the standard at all.
Not even close. In antiquity, pearls were the absolute zenith of wealth and status. The Roman historian Pliny the Elder actually ranked pearls as the highest priced goods in the entire Roman Empire.
Which makes total sense when you dig into how they were actually acquired. Like, you didn't just mine them out of a rock wall.
Oh, definitely not.
They were harvested by free divers in the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the Indian Ocean. And there's no scuba gear. There are no oxygen tanks. These divers were holding their breath, tying rocks to their feet to sink faster, and risking drowning, shark attacks, and the bends, all to pry open a shell that might be totally empty.
The human cost was just staggering.
Yeah. The human cost of extracting a single, perfectly spherical pearl was astronomical.
So when the text says the merchant finds one single pearl of great price, we're talking about an object of such concentrated, absurd wealth that it defies calculation.
Wow.
It's literally the crown jewel of an empire just sitting in his hand.
So if we establish that these finds are the absolute apex of ancient wealth, like a lottery ticket for the peasant and a crown jewel for the merchant, the next logical question is, what does the winner's panic look like?
Oh, it's intense.
Because claiming the prize wasn't simple. They both had to liquidate their lives to get it. And here is where the research completely flips the script on how we understand their reaction.
This is exactly where the work of Joachim Jeremias becomes essential.
Okay, tell us about him.
Well, Jeremias was a premier 20th century scholar of ancient parables. And he pointed out a massive flaw in how these stories have been interpreted for centuries.
Oh, okay.
If you look at the history of church sermons and commentaries, particularly developing through the Middle Ages, they focus heavily on the grim sacrifice of these two men.
Right. There is this pervasive, heavy focus on the cost of discipleship. The traditional narrative is very solemn. It feels like a lecture, you know? Like, look at how much they gave up. You too must painfully detach yourself from all your worldly possessions, suffer through poverty, and reject joy to be spiritual.
But why did that interpretation develop? Jeremias argues it's because the later church adopted a highly ascetic theology.
Ah.
With the rise of monasticism, you know, monks going out into the desert, the veneration of martyrs, the idea that suffering itself was inherently holy.
So they read their own culture into it.
Exactly. Theologians started reading their own cultural fixation on grim sacrifice backward into the text. They turned the parables into this heavy, miserable tax you had to pay to access heaven.
Right.
But Jeremiah says that entirely misses the mechanism of the text. He points to the original Greek in the first parable. The driving engine of the laborer's action is the phrase apotos kerasoto,
which translates to
in his joy.
In his joy. Meaning the liquidation of their assets isn't a burdensome, depressing duty at all.
Not at all. Jeremias argues it is the logical, ecstatic response to finding something of disproportionate value. It is not an act of grim willpower.
Let me try a different analogy here, because it has to be more extreme than just cashing in a winning lottery ticket.
Go for it.
It's like finding out you have a terminal illness and your organs are shutting down, but you discover there is one single vial of a cure left in the world.
Ooh, okay.
You don't solemnly and sadly put your house on the market and weep over selling your car to afford the medical bill. You do it in a state of frantic, joyful desperation.
Yes.
You are practically throwing the keys at people, because keeping the car means you lose your life anyway. The sheer value of the cure makes the loss of your stuff completely irrelevant.
That captures the frantic energy perfectly. You aren't mourning the loss of the house. You're ecstatic because you see the math.
Exactly.
And that is what Jeremias is highlighting. The parables teach that the kingdom of heaven is a discovery so overwhelmingly valuable that letting go of everything else requires absolutely no hesitation.
But acting on that ecstatic joy looks downright crazy to the outside world.
Completely crazy.
Which brings us to the actual radical life changes these discoveries demanded. Let's look at the economic subversion at play here, because modern scholars like Amy Jill Levine and William Herzog frame this as deeply subversive.
They do, because these parables completely dismantle standard economic rationality.
Yeah.
Consider the merchant's mechanics. His entire identity, his social standing, and his livelihood are built on the principles of commerce.
Buying and selling.
Right. Buying, holding inventory, selling for profit. He needs capital. He needs a network. He needs a shop.
But when he finds this single pearl, the text says he sells all that he had, which means he liquidates his home, his business, his remaining inventory, his ledgers, his staff.
Everything.
Literally everything.
You buy one single pearl.
Yeah.
Economically speaking, Levin and Herzog point out, this is a kamikaze move.
Yeah.
He is no longer a merchant. He has no capital left to trade. He has zero diversification in his portfolio.
Mm.
And practically speaking, he cannot eat a pearl.
No, he cannot.
He has effectively ruined his own societal survival metrics to possess this one thing.
He becomes a fool to the market.
He does. To the rest of the ancient Mediterranean economy, the merchant has lost his mind. But the text argues that the merchant is the only one who truly understands the ultimate metric of value.
Okay, but what about the tenant farmer? Because when I look at the gritty realism of his deal, I see a massive ethical problem.
Oh, the ethics of the field. Let's get into it.
Let's look at the sequence of events. He's digging in a field owned by a wealthy landlord. He finds a buried jar of gold. Instead of bringing it to the owner of the dirt, he covers it back up, keeps his mouth shut, scrapes together his meager savings, and buys the field from the landlord on the cheap, knowing there's a fortune under the surface. Doesn't he basically just steal the treasure through a shady real estate hustle?
Right. It's a fantastic question. And it's one that scholars debate heavily because it touches on the complex property laws of the era. To understand the ethics, we have to look at rabbinic law, which was later codified in the Mishnah, a collection of Jewish oral traditions.
So what did the Mishnah say about finding buried treasure? Was it just finders keepers?
The legal framework was highly specific and differentiated between two types of finds.
Okay.
The law stated that if a worker found a scattered treasure, say a handful of coins dropped and lost on the surface of the soil, it belonged to the finder.
Makes sense.
The logic was that the original owner had clearly abandoned it or lost it beyond recovery. But if the treasure was intentionally hidden, meaning it was sealed in a jar and buried deep in the earth, it legally belonged to the landowner, regardless of who swung the shovel.
So if the farmer just pulls the jar out of the ground and walks away with it, he is definitively a thief under the law.
Yes.
The landlord could have him arrested.
Right. So he uses a loophole, he hides it again, he buries it back in the dirt, and then he goes and buys the field at its base agricultural value, just the cost of a plot of dirt.
Right.
By legally transferring the deed of the land, he becomes the landowner and thereby ensures his complete, unassailable legal right to the treasure beneath it.
That is incredibly shrewd, but it is a massive ethical gray area. I mean, he is withholding crucial market information from the seller. Is Jesus endorsing real estate fraud here?
Scholars emphasize that Jesus is not offering a seminar on ethical business practices here.
Good to know.
He isn't saying, go and trick your neighbors to get ahead.
Yeah.
Rather, he is using a relatable, morally gray, street-level scenario that his peasant audience would have instantly recognized and probably chuckled at.
Because they would have respected the hustle. They were all oppressed by wealthy landlords anyway.
Precisely. The point of the narrative mechanism is this. When you see the ultimate prize, you act decisively. You use every tool at your disposal. You leverage the legal loopholes. You do whatever it takes within your power to secure it. The sheer value of the treasure overrides polite, conventional behavior.
Okay, so up until now, we've been looking at these sources as a direct guide for how you and I should react to discovering ultimate value.
Right.
We are the ones digging in the dirt. We are the ones searching the markets for the pearl. We have to sell everything we own. We have to make the crazy sacrifice. But what if we've been reading ourselves into the wrong role the entire time?
This is perhaps the most fascinating shift in the theological research. If we pan out and connect this to the broader arc of early Christian theology, we encounter what scholars call the Christological inversion.
The Christological inversion. Okay, how does that mechanism work?
So modern historical critical scholars usually view the parables as a template for human reaction. But the early church fathers took a completely different approach. Theologians like Irenaeus, writing back in the second century, reversed the allegory entirely.
Wait, if you flip the allegory, then we aren't the ones looking for the treasure. That would make us... That feels like a massive theological leap. How did the early church justify casting humanity as the prize?
They justified it through the lens of the incarnation. In the patristic view, Christ is the merchant. Christ is the day laborer. Humanity, or the church, is the hidden treasure buried in the dirt of the world. Humanity is the pearl of great price.
Hold on, I have to push back on this.
Sure.
Isn't that just a convenient way for early theologians to soften a really harsh, demanding lesson?
How do you mean?
If the original text clearly says, sell everything you have and give up your life, flipping it so that Jesus does all the hard work feels like a total cop-out for the listener.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying, oh good, I get to keep all my stuff and my comfortable life because Jesus is the one paying the price.
It's a fair critique, and it's actually one modern scholars often leverage against the patristic readings.
Really?
Yeah. But the early church fathers weren't looking for a cop-out. They were attempting to solve a massive theological problem regarding merit versus grace. If the parables are merely a transactional to-do list, if you have to perfectly liquidate your life to afford heaven, then it becomes a works-based religion where only the deeply ascendant or the wealthy can buy their way in. Irenaeus and others reframed it as an ontological rescue mission.
A rescue mission.
Yes. Christ, who already possesses the infinite riches of heaven, sees the immense value in this broken, buried treasure of humanity.
Right.
And he joyfully, willingly gives up everything, liquidating his heavenly assets, taking on human form, and ultimately giving his own life to purchase the field.
And the field is?
The field being the world. He buys the whole broken world just to redeem the treasure he valued so highly.
That synthesis entirely changes the narrative. I mean, it completely shifts the tone of the text from a demanding self-help manual about our exhausting, frantic search for meaning into a profound love story.
It really does.
It's no longer about how hard I have to work or how much I have to bleed to find the divine. It's about being the object of someone else's ultimate joy-filled search.
It changes the burden of the parables completely. If you read it through Irenaeus's eyes, the radical life change and the economic subversion were undertaken by the divine on your behalf. You aren't the exhausted merchant. You are the pearl.
What a journey. From the brutal grit of Levantine economics and the sheer terror of hiding your life savings from an invading Roman legion to freebiving in the Red Sea without oxygen for a status symbol.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
It is. We've traced the subversion of societal wealth, navigated ethically dubious real estate deals in the Mishnah, all the way to entirely flipped allegories where the divine gives up the cosmos to buy the world.
It's incredibly rich source material.
So turning to you, the listener, as you think about your own life, which camp do you naturally fall into? Are you the laborer just trying to survive the daily grind, hoping to stumble upon grace in the middle of a mundane Tuesday? Or are you the merchant on a lifelong, intentional, relentless quest for truth? And whatever your pearl is right now, are you using the right metrics to value it?
Those are the crucial questions for anyone analyzing these texts. And I actually want to leave you with one final conceptual puzzle to mull over.
Oh, perfect.
Something that builds on the economic reality of these parables. Let's go back to the merchant for a second. We established the mechanism of his choice. He liquidated his entire life, his home, his business, and his very identity as a trader to acquire this one singular pearl of great price.
Right.
He has it in his hand. The ultimate transaction is complete. But the parables end right there.
They do.
They don't tell us what happens next. Yeah. So what does the merchant do the next morning?
That's a great question.
When he wakes up, he has no shop to open. He has no ledgers to balance, he has no network to call, and no inventory to sort. He just possesses the ultimate value. How do you live on day two, when the search that defined your entire existence is finally over?